From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Monica Lewis was a big band singer in the 1940s, an actress in movies and on radio, a recording star, and a successful nightclub performer. She passed away on June 12th at the age of 93. In 2011, she wrote a memoir, and we got a chance to talk. And this week, we listened back to my interview with Monica Lewis. And one of the things I love about your book, you really lay it on the line. You don't hold back. You tell us everything.
Well, I tried to tell the truth. That was the main thing.
Well, one of the things that intrigued me, and there's so many wonderful illustrations in the book, you opened for Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis at the Copacabana in 1948, and there's this tantalizing poster in the book that says you did three shows a night, including a 2 a.m. show. Take us back to that event. What was that like?
Oh, my God. Those days, everybody did it. So that was the way you did. You did an 8 o'clock dinner show and then a midnight show for people who had been to the... This was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So people went to the theater and would come after theater and, you know, have a late supper or whatever. And then at 2:15, when most people would have gone home, you had a sufficient number that the places would keep open. And they would just shorten the dancing girls number a little bit, and cut a little bit here and there. But when Dean and Jerry were there, they were packed at 2:15.
Wow!
So we had a full show. It wasn't just six, indigent drunks who wanted it, or rich ones, mainly.
But how many people could be seated in the Copacabana?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Frankly, I don't know. The seating capacity, it's hard for me to remember that.
Yeah. What was Martin and Lewis's act like, and how did it feel to open for them? Was the audience receptive to your singing?
Well, I probably couldn't wait till Dean and Jerry got out, but I had enough of my own ability to keep them interested and like me, and they loved me, and then here they are, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis. But I did a full show, and it was very... We were there forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody got booked in probably for 2 weeks or a month at the most, and we were there forever. It was a very amazing rise for both of them. I knew them both before that. But they
yeah.
were not who they were, who they became,
It was it's one thing that those of us who weren't there, fortunate enough to see them live, apparently we'll never know, because people say seeing them live was the only way to really see them.
Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. First of all, Dean was very handsome at that time, and he was always a nice-looking guy, but, I mean, he was very handsome. And Jerry was a total clown. And they played off each other in the most unbelievably... it seemed everything was so casual, but they knew what they were doing. And they were marvelous. They were really marvelous.
Well, there was a writer who wrote for Fred Allen, who many people have heard of. He's one of my heroes. And then I find out from you that he's kind of a stuffy guy. That was Herman Woke.
Yeah.
You dated him. Yes,
he was the families were friends, and then I knew him growing up, but he waited till I was 18 to ask me out.
Well, that was polite of him.
Yeah.
And you think you appear in one of his novels? You're not Marjorie Morningstar, are you?
Could be, but the Mae Wynn character, that I think was in Winds of War, wasn't it?
Kate Mutiny.
Kate Mutiny, yeah. Mae Wynn was the name of the girl in that, and the actress who played her, whose name escapes me this minute, took the name of Mae Wynn as her professional name.
Yeah, she's just billed as Mae Wynn in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he based that, I think, on me. And he probably did Marjorie Morningstar. He says he did it about his sister, but I don't think so. I think that he was
thinking of you.
Putting it all together about the ambition and the drive and the theatrical aspirations. His sister did want to be an actress, but nothing much happened. She married a doctor and had a nice, normal life.
Your life was nice, but not particularly normal.
Well, it wasn't average, let's put it that way. I try to keep it normal, but it was normal in the sense of organization and basic philosophy and my optimism and my caring about my family and the way I was. I don't know how I got to be that way, but that's who I was. And love of music.
Yes. Well, and you're a marvelous singer. Do you still sing?
I sang pretty well until just recently. In this last year, we had some horrendous fires in Los Angeles. And they whipped up a lot of trees and lots of new pollens and stuff. And I just coughed so much that when I had my cupness come over and started to sing, I said, my high notes are just really awful, and I don't know what's going on, but I don't like the sound. And he said, oh, but you still can interpret, and you make me cry when you sing this, and you swing, and you can do this. I said, but I can't listen to it. I made him laugh, and I said, yeah, I make Diana Krall, who sings low, you know.
Yeah.
I said, I make her sound like a soprano. I'm singing down here. And he said, well, it's kind of sexy. I said, well, maybe for you, but it's doing nothing for me.
Who were the singers that influenced you?
Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
When I was 16 or so, I started to listen to, I listened to bands. In those days, we had big bands, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was with Chick Webb, I think. And
she had that kind of girlish voice. Your voice seems much more mature. You always sounded very...
Yes.
Yeah.
But she deepened later. Everybody does.
Right.
So you get a deeper chest tone. If you listen to the old Sarah Vaughan records...
Yes, oh yeah.
In her early days, very high.
Yes.
And then later it got very full and throaty and deep.
Yeah.
That's what the vocal cords are very funny. People don't realize they're these two little things in the throat. And as you grow older, they thicken so that the breath, you know, because singing is breathing. You have to breathe. And the air doesn't vibrate through them as fast. So that's why you get a deeper sound. Sinatra did it. I mean, everybody.
Was it harder to sing at 2 o'clock in the morning than at 7 o'clock in the evening?
Oh, I never thought anything was too hard. I was like a robot. Here's what you do. This is what you do. This is, you know,
yeah.
Get your paycheck. Give it to your mama.
Well, you mentioned Frank Sinatra. Now, he's one of the boys you said no to.
Yes, but he was a lifelong friend.
Yeah.
He was like a big brother. He really was.
Yeah.
I said no when I was all very early and on the phone.
Even if he'd asked you in person, you might have said yes?
I didn't say that. I'm glad it was on the phone because there's no scene. It was simple.
Well, speaking of people you said no to, you said no to a marriage proposal to this B-movie actor. Some people might remember. His name was Ronald Reagan.
Yep.
Although you went with him for a couple of years.
Yes.
And then you actively campaigned against him when he ran for governor of California.
Well, that's because he had switched parties. When I was seeing him, he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, which was, you know, actors, the pretty liberal people.
Yeah.
And so am I. And so was he.
So you didn't vote for your ex-beau when he
no,
was...
No, I did not. He became a Republican, and he went very far, as we all know, and he was a lovely man, and a very, very...
Was he? What was he like in the days when you knew him?
Delightful. He was charming. He was kind. He was a good-natured guy who, he would get rid of his frustrations by going up to a ranch and cutting wood and doing physical stuff, and you know. But he was not intellectually one of the five greatest minds in the country. But there was nothing wrong with it, and he was hip enough. I don't know if he was hip enough for me at that point in my life, and I think that maybe was the problem. I was in that period where I only really liked writers and comics and Ronnie. And so, you know, you go through stages of growing up. I don't know how it would have been 10 years later if I had grown up more or what. But I had fallen in love immediately anyway with a writer. And I knew I made the right choice, even though that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Monica Lewis, and she's just written her memoirs, Hollywood Through My Eyes. You worked with so many of the great ones, and I want to ask you about some of them because they're some of my heroes.
Sure.
I've been listening to a lot of your records and radio performances, and I heard you on the Bing Crosby radio show. What kind of a guy was Bing?
Well, he was just lovely to me. Again, he I did not know in the way that I knew some of these other people. I knew him to work with.
Yeah.
And he was just delightful and very protective. I had a wonderful experience with most of the big names because there was something that maybe made them feel protective about me. I don't know what it was. I don't know why it was, but it was. And that was helpful because certainly the guys who ran the nightclubs were not like that. You know, they were aggressive guys and you had to run like hell. Is that allowed to be said on your...
Yes, you can say anything you like.
Okay. Well, it's like I had roller skates, you know. I'm very, very... see ya. Show's over. Out. Gone.
Nobody got you on the casting couch, but many tried. Is that right?
Well, I think that was just par for the course for most people. You had to know how to duck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about singing duets with singers? Were some singers easier to sing with than others?
Yes. I can think of a bad example.
Good. Do tell.
Well, Eddie Fisher.
Yeah. Not a good duet singer?
No. Well, the problem, Eddie had a wonderful voice.
Yeah.
And he could, you know, sing, "Oh, My Papa," and make you cry and all of that. But he couldn't swing, and he had a rhythm problem. So we did a television show together. And we had to do this duet, and I figured out if I put my arm around his shoulder instead of his having his around mine. We were in a hansom cab in Central Park.
Yeah.
And I tapped him on the shoulder.
You were the human metronome.
Yes, I was the metronome and kept the beat going. Like, let's say it had to be you. It had to be you. Well, I kept pushing so that it would be, like, right. And we got through it fine, and everybody just loved it. And I'm telling you this story, and it's okay. And if Eddie's up there in heaven or wherever he is, he's smiling down saying, "She's telling the truth."
Well, who was the easiest, then, to sing duets with?
Well, I'm just trying to remember. I never had a problem. Most of the people were so professional.
Yeah.
You know, that you just...
When you were on radio, was there a lot of time for rehearsal, or did you just come in and do it?
Well, that depended in the very early days, because, you know, I was born in 1922, so this...
That would make you 39.
Well, I'm going to be 90 in May. So
congratulations.
Thank you. May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. Sometimes we had rehearsal, and sometimes we didn't, and it depended on whether you used an arrangement that was orchestrated, you know, that they had to run it down once at least to see what the trumpet player is supposed to do. But on the Armed Forces radio stuff that I did for years and years and years, you know, voluntarily, and that's why I made such friends with the troops and all of that, I would just call in my keys to the piano player, and I'd say, "This is the key I'm going to do the song in," and that's it.
So when you did Armed Forces Radio, there was no pay for that? You didn't get paid for mail call or whatever?
Oh, no.
What about when you made V-discs?
No. That was no. The V discs were a separate. Let me see, how did that work? Well, if I was usually under contract to a record company, so the permission to use it on the V disc was probably made through them with the government. I don't remember that. I don't remember how that was done on the financial side. But it wasn't a question of selling those records anyways. They were not for sale. They were played in all the bedside radios for all the wounded kids and whom I would visit.
That's a pretty wild... there's a picture in your book. Everybody should get it just to see this picture of you. You look like you're naked, but you're wearing a strapless bathing suit.
Yes.
And you're holding a giant V-disc in front
exactly.
of you.
That picture is so cute. And my son made a cutout of it. You know how you have these little cardboard cutouts?
Yeah.
And it's in my front of my piano. And I said, can you walk in the house and see this? He gave this to me at Christmas. It's hilarious.
It's very beautiful.
It's funny. I'm a great son, by the way.
Oh, good. we're talking with Monica Lewis, the great vocalist, and she's just written her memoir, Hollywood Through My Eyes. You had some very complimentary and a little shocking things to say about Kirk Douglas.
Well, what did I say?
You said you enjoyed his company.
Oh yeah, I did. Oh, that's for sure. We had a very good time. We had a wonderful time. That was about the time that all these people were emerging. I think that Stanley Kramer was making a big smash in motion pictures, and Marlon Brando was in The Men, and then Kirk was in another one at the time. But they were all coming to New York to do publicity, and everybody was wanted to have dinner with me. So out of that group, I thought Kirk was pretty cute. And we had a very good time. He's a very nice man.
Some nice memories there.
Yes, a lot of nice memories.
You were the guest. You were a guest on the first Ed Sullivan show.
Yes.
Well, Ed Sullivan, you know, is kind of fascinating because he's not particularly talented. He can't sing or dance. He can't tell a joke. He can't even introduce the acts very well. How did he become such a smash?
Because my brother and the American public. I was working with Ed at the Low State Theater in New York. They did a show every year of the Harvest Moon Ball where they had kids from all over the country audition. Something like American Idol now, but for dancing, but not like Dancing with the Stars. These were kids.
Yeah.
You know, 16 to 18, something like that. Upper high school, first year college. And whoever won got to appear on this show, and he had me as his guest vocalist, and he had Paul Winchell, who had a dummy named Jerry Mahoney. It was
remember it well.
Quest act, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were the show. And one night, my brother came to call for me after the show, and Ed sternly said to me, "Who is that?" You know, and I said, "That's my brother." He said, "Oh yeah, I'm sure." You know, I said, "No, please come and meet him. This is legitimately my brother." Well, my brother happened to be really handsome, movie star handsome. And that's why when he was standing in the corner, you know, Ed immediately assumed this was a boyfriend. And so I introduced him, and I said to Ed, "You know, you really ought to talk to Marlo because he has such great ideas. He runs the Luncheon at Sardi's show, and he's in advertising, and he's... you know, just a fabulous guy, and he has so many ideas that might help you break out from being the sportscaster and the guy you are into what you really are trying to do is to break into television." So they made a lunch date, and out of that, Marlo decided to put in a plan, and he sold it to CBS, and at which point they made Marlo head of music, comedy, and... something else, that he was vice president of all that. because they thought Marla was a genius.
Hmm.
Now, Ed couldn't do anything, as you know, as far as being an entertainer. But Marla said, it's okay. We'll get great acts. And everybody, this is, television is so new. And everybody will say, well, there's a guy just like me. Or the everyday man will say, you don't have to be a great talent. You don't have to be Fred Astaire to run and be on a show. So it worked.
Yeah.
It worked. It had the longest running show in history of television.
Yeah, and so your brother was responsible for the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all that stuff.
A lot of it.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
Elvis.
Elvis, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we remember him here. Daniel Ellsberg, he was at the tippy top of President Nixon's enemies list. He was the RAND Corporation think tank employee who leaked the top secret Pentagon report to the press in 1971. The Pentagon Papers exposed lies from the administration about America's involvement in Vietnam. How did you get involved in the Ellsberg case?
Well, now, by this time, I was married to my love of my life, Jennings Lang, who was my husband.
He was a Universal executive.
Yes, mm-hmm. And a producer, and wonderful guy. And we were both very involved with the Democratic Party, and we thought exactly alike about almost everything, which was lucky, and lucky for me. And we were approached by ACLU to, if we would do a party to raise money to pay for Danny Ellsberg's court costs, because he was broke. And we said yes. And we gave a fantastic party. We raised the money. He paid his lawyers. And, of course, he was vindicated. So that was a real coup. And, of course, I got to know Dan Ellsberg and his wife and through all of that. They were lovely people.
And that was was that the height of your involvement in politics, or did you continue to be involved?
Always involved.
Yeah.
Always.
What about now?
Well, I can't do what I used to do. I can't do a lot of things I used to do. So I do the best I can, you know. I don't belong to any committees or anything like that anymore. Honey, I'm lucky to be sitting here and talking to you.
Well, I'm the lucky one. I get to talk to you.
But I am involved, and I care a lot.
Yeah.
And I really find that this climate politically is just so disgusting. And the other day, I actually turned off, you know, the television just because I just couldn't watch it anymore for that day. You know, it's just so upsetting to hear this bickering and this childishness, that sophomoric tit-for-tat crap. It's just so heartbreaking, because the country shouldn't be doing that. The country's too good for that.
Well, of course, I agree with you completely.
I'm a very patriotic person, and I love this country. And I love every single person who has done good for this country. And everyone isn't perfect, but what's going on now is disgusting. And
is this, I mean, since you've been around a long time and seen a lot of it, is this the worst it's ever been?
It is, for me, and it perhaps is because we've been so inundated with it, because
there's so much TV now.
It's so much. It's just too much, and it's too much of the same thing. And it's all gotcha. And it's all, I'll find out what dirt I could get on you. You know, it's kind of, they lose sight of what it's about.
Well, when you were there at the birth of television, you were there in the very early days of TV, did you ever dream how gigantic it would become?
No. But it's amazing, because I've told the story, which I told in the book, I think, is we didn't have even a dolly camera. If people don't know what that is, it's one that zooms in. It doesn't even zoom in. With rides in on a track.
Right.
We didn't have any equipment. And so I was singing I'm in the Mood for Love, and they had to hide the microphone in a bunch of flowers, like a bouquet. And the cameraman had to go on his knees in front of me 3 feet and photograph me for the close-up. And I'm singing this song, and the light from his camera was so bright that my eyes teared, and everyone thought that wonderful actress.
What a great actress.
Yeah, right. What a great actress. And I think I got $50. I don't remember whether I got $25 or $50 for that show. But we started something.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you're best known for, I don't know how you feel about that, but is that you were the Chiquita Banana Girl.
Oh, boy. I tell you, I feel good about it because that paid my rent for about 14 years. And
Could you give us a little taste of that Chiquita Banana?
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way. And when they're flecked with brown, they have a golden hue. Bananas taste the best and are the best for you.
Oh, thank you.
It was, I think, the most sought-after jingle of all time. And then I did all their cartoons that they put.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember them well. And I was sort of surprised to see that really dated back a while. You did start doing that in the 40s?
Yeah, I think so.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I sometimes get the dates a little bit mixed up, but it had to be the 40s I started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about a couple more of your friends and acquaintances. Benny Goodman, you started singing with Benny Goodman's orchestra.
That was really early.
Yeah. What kind of a guy was Benny?
Well, he was very lovely to me, again. He called me kid.
Well, you were a kid.
Yeah. But he was enamored of my father. He was just absolutely couldn't wait for my dad to come to the Astor Roof and hang out. You know, when I was working, and because my dad was a classical pianist, composer, and conductor, and they could talk about Schubert and Schumann, because Benny was secretly, you know, a very big classicist, and they would talk about quintets and all this stuff. He hardly ever talked to me, except, you're doing good, kid, you know, you're doing good, kid, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So he wasn't the tyrant that some people have said?
I don't know about it.
Yeah.
He does. It certainly was not with me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a big Sergeant Bilko fan. I liked Phil Silvers a lot, and so did you.
Oh, he was a wonderful guy. And that was my brother's show, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He got that put that together.
It was a great show.
Wasn't it funny?
Yeah, it's still funny.
I know. He was a terrific comedian.
There's more jokes in the first 5 minutes of Bilko than there is in the entire season of most of the comedies.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Great writing.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. I'm still waiting for a big laugh. You know?
Yeah, when you watch sitcoms now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were so well written.
Yeah, they had some great writers on that show.
Yes, they were fabulous writers. And those guys were all friends of my brother. They were all just so marvelous. They were older than I was, all of them, but, you know, 8, 10 years old at least. And I was not, and many were married and so forth, but they were very, very brilliant guys, and I knew them as just socially in the sense of I knew them. But they were very close to him.
Hollywood Through My Eyes, The Lives and Loves of a Golden Age Siren by Monica Lewis. And what a thrill it is for me to get to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and I hope everyone reads it because I think it's a good story.
It's great. And
there's
wonderful pictures in it, too.
Oh, those pictures are priceless, aren't they?
And you're priceless.
Oh, thank you so much.
How lucky I was to have had the chance to talk with Monica Lewis. She died on June 12th at the age of 93. And that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.